well, I'm sure the chairman's right, that the, I think that's something that we become more impressed with as we go through the story of the disciples, that, you see, it's obvious really, isn't it? All of us have got problems in life, but the whole story of the truth is that the truth is designed to change us. And it will change us, and it can change us, if we're prepared to allow it to work in our lives. But if we're not prepared to do that, then we will become a Judas, and the Lord ultimately will have no further use for us. And so the thing about that is that none of us come to the truth with a ready developed character that's mature in the truth. We have to allow the influence of the word to work in us over a period of time. And so Peter had to learn that too, didn't he? Well, the man that we're going to look at now is a very different person to Peter. How would you describe Peter? What would you, how would you sort of summarise Peter's character? Yep. Enthusiastic. That would be a good word for Peter, wouldn't it? You know, you'd have to be enthusiastic to get out the side of a boat and walk on water. He was that sort of person, but at the root of his enthusiasm was a sort of confidence in his own ability. Oh, I'll be able to do it. And of course that was in fact the key to Peter's weakness, wasn't it? That he had to learn not to trust in himself. Now, John never had that problem. You know, John was a very different disciple to Peter. John never had a problem about being confident in himself. John's confidence was always founded on the Father. He was actually a much more spiritual person than Peter. He was actually a much deeper thinker than Peter. He had a better spiritual mind than Peter. He was more attuned to the Lord's teaching than Peter. In some ways, we might say, therefore, that Peter was, that John was actually more spiritually mature in some ways. But John had a problem all the same. And it was quite a different problem to Peter's. Now, the key to John's life is in Mark chapter 3. And here's the key reference that really opens up for us the problem in John's life and what it was that Jesus was trying to work on here. Because, of course, you see, what we're really learning here is that Christ had to work with all of these disciples to help to change them. Now, Jesus knew whom he'd chosen. He knew the strengths and weaknesses of every one of his disciples, and he certainly knew the problem that John had. And here's the problem. Now, in Mark chapter 3, we have the story of the calling of the 12. It says in verse 13, he goes up into a mountain and calls unto them whom he would. And what we're not told there, but Luke's gospel record tells us, in Luke chapter 6 and verse 12, was that Jesus actually spent the whole night in prayer before he made this decision. So he didn't choose these 12 men lightly, and he didn't make mistakes. He spent the whole night agonizing over those 12 names. And John's one of them. Now here he is. Let's go through verse 16. Well, here's the list. Simon, his surname Peter, and James the son of Zebedee, and John the brother of James, and he surnamed them Boanerges, which is the sons of thunder, and Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James, etc., etc. So John is one of the two sons of Zebedee, we know, but they're called here Boanerges, which is the sons of thunder. Now, in the what we have here is a Greek form of a Hebrew word. What's the Hebrew word for son? Ben. And so, how does that come through into the Greek? How do we normally see it? It's actually normally Bar, isn't it? So we have Simon Bar Jonas, Simon son of Jonah, instead of Simon Ben Jonas. Well, this Boa is actually another form of Ben, really. And you see the at the end of that, you've got the word, the phrase R-G-E-S. So you've got Boaner and then R-G-E-S. Now that is actually an abbreviated form of the Hebrew word ragaz. R-A-G-A-Z. So if you like, in the Hebrew form of Boanerges, what we have is Ben-Rogaz. That's the Hebrew form of Boanerges. Ben-Rogaz, the son of Rogaz. Now it says in Mark here that it means the sons of thunder. But Jesenius says that this is what the word Rogaz means. It means to be moved by any one of the following things. Now listen to these. Listen to these. I'm going to put three on an imaginary this side and three on this side. It means to be moved with rage, to be moved with anger, or to be moved with wrath. That's one side of Rogaz. And the other side is that it can also mean to be moved with grief, to be moved with awe, or to be moved with joy. That's what Rogaz means. I'll just say those again. See the two sides of the word? To be moved with rage or anger or wrath, but also to be capable of being moved with grief or with awe or with joy. And so Strong's says that Rogaz means to quiver with any violent emotion. That's what Rogaz means. To quiver with any violent emotion. Now here's John, and here's his problem. He is, and Jesus knew it because Jesus gives him this name. He is the son of Rogaz. John's problem was he was very intense. That was his problem. Peter had to learn to overcome impetuosity. John had to learn to overcome intensity. Whatever he felt very intense. He was a very intense sort of person. He felt strongly about things. That was a problem. Because sometimes John felt so strongly that he trod on top of everybody else. And Jesus was going to have to take John and say, "Now look, John, you might be right on the principle, but you've got to learn to temper that strength of feeling with a little care and consideration for others." He was far too strong. You ever come across people like that? I guess we all can be like that at times. There's something that we feel strongly about, and we get involved in an argument, and we sit there shaking, and we can feel the blood pounding at our temples, and we say, "No, I don't agree," and you get far too strong about something. That was John. He was always like that. He was a naturally intense. Ever come across someone like that? That everything they do is very intense. They're that sort of person. They're not a relaxed person. They're not relaxed at all. They're an intense person. Their whole life is wound up like a spring. And you're very careful not to touch it in case it uncoils rapidly. Now, you see, when Jesus gave John that name, what Jesus was really saying here was, "I know this man's problem." Now let's come and have a look and see what happens. Three times the Lord has to rebuke John for that spirit of intensity. Now here's the first one. It's in the Gospel of Mark. We'll use Mark. It's in a number of records, but we'll use the one in Mark chapter 9 by way of illustration. Mark chapter 9. Verse 38. And John answered him, saying, "Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and he followeth not us, and we forbade him, because he followeth not us." Now, notice the spirit of John on this occasion. First of all, you see the key word. One thing we can say about John is he might have been intense, but the one thing was, above everything else with John, is he loved Christ. In fact, we know that, don't we? Because what's he described as in his own gospel record? Pretty close to that. What's the exact phrase in the Gospel of John? "The disciple whom Jesus loved." Now, you stop and think about this. This is an amazing thing. You see, do you think there was a touch of pride in Peter? Imagine there was a touch of pride in Peter. I think there was at times, you know. He thought of himself as a pretty capable sort of bloke and, you know, at the forefront of things. I don't think there was that sort of pride in John. John never had a problem with pride in that way. He was very intense about things, but you stop and think of, how could you write a gospel in which you describe yourself as the disciple whom Jesus loved without pride? Could you write that? Most of us would have just a tinge of pride in saying that, wouldn't we? I don't think there was any pride when that was. You see, John knew that was true. He was the disciple whom Jesus loved, and he loved Jesus. You know, it says, doesn't it? It says of Jesus in John chapter 1 that no man has seen the Father, the only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared. Remember that phrase in John chapter 1? The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. And that phrase, in the bosom, represents the tremendous closeness between God and his Son. And there's only one other person of whom that phrase is used, isn't it? And it's John himself, who lay on the bosom of Jesus at the time of the upper room. And there was a tremendous closeness between John and his master. John loved Christ, and he knew that Christ loved him. There was no pride in that. He was able to write that in his gospel without any trace of pride. It was a humble statement of fact. But he was too strong. Now here it is, verse 38. John said, Master. You see, everything that John said always revolved around anything that affected Christ. He was very sensitive to what affected Christ. Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and he follows not us, and we forbade him because he follows not us. Now he says he follows not us, but what he really means, of course, is that he wasn't following Christ. That's what upset John. It wasn't so much that he wasn't following us, but what upset John about this man was that he was casting out miracles in the name of Jesus, but he wasn't following Jesus. And that's not good enough, says John, as far as John was concerned. He was very upset about that. He felt that was wrong. Can you see John quivering there? Well, I can just see him shaking. And you see how he handles the issue. Verse 38, and he follows not up, and we forbade him. Oh, can you see John striding up to this man, flashing eyes? How dare you do that? You stop that at once. In fact, the word forbade here means to prevent by word or act. To prevent. John stopped him, all right. Says, I fixed him. Far too strong, wasn't he? You see the problem with the man? Now, he might have been right. There may have been a principle here that John was right on, but the way he went about it was far, far too strong. And Jesus said, verse 39, forbid him not, for there is no man which shall do a miracle in my name that can lightly speak evil of me. Now, you know, this whole incident is actually strangely reminiscent of something that happened a long time ago. Come back to the life of Moses. See if you can recognize this story in the life of Moses. Numbers chapter 11. Remember this little incident in the story of Numbers? See how strangely similar this story is. It says in Numbers chapter 11 and verse 25, it says that Yahweh came down in a cloud and spake unto him and took of the spirit that was upon Moses and gave it unto the 70 elders. And it came to pass that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied and did not cease. But there remained two of the men in the camp. The name of the one was Eldad, and the name of the other Medad. And the Spirit rested upon them, and they were of them that were written, but they didn't go out into the tabernacle. They prophesied in the camp. And there ran a young man and told Moses, and said, Eldad and Medad do prophesy in the camp. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of Moses, one of his young men answered and said, my Lord Moses, forbid them. You see John here? And Moses said, enviest thou for my sake? Would God that all Yahweh's people were prophets, and that Yahweh would put his spirit upon them. Now you see the aggressiveness of Joshua here. Alright, there was a decisive strength of purpose here. You see, they said, these men, they haven't followed you, Moses, they've partaken of your spirit, and here they are prophesying in the camp, and they oughtn't to do that. Now you forbid them, says Joshua. And Moses says, Joshua, would to God that all the ecclesia have that spirit. Now you see that answer of Moses there. Envious thou from would God that all Yahweh's people were prophets. Now come back to Mark chapter 11. You know, by the way, it's in the margin, in case you haven't noticed that, so it's not really a clever reference, just a case of using your margins carefully. In Mark chapter 9, verse 38, it's under P. But you can see how that incident in the Old Testament is clearly the foundation for this little story here in Mark. And no doubt, by the way, Jesus knew that. Jesus said, verse 39, John, he says, forbid him not, for there is no man which shall do a miracle in my name that can lightly speak evil of me, for he that's not against us is on our part. He's really, it's the same spirit as Moses, isn't it? Look, says Jesus. He says, whoever's not against us is for us. Would God all the ecclesia had that power to do? Don't be like that, John. Now you see, what Jesus is doing in this story of Mark chapter 9, verses 38 to 40 is, he is rebuking John on this occasion for short-sighted aggressiveness. That's what it's about. He's rebuking John for short-sighted aggressiveness. John saw a problem, he felt so intense about it, he said, forbid him. Jesus says, look, you're being far too strong, John. In fact, you see how he uses John's own term, verse 38. John says, he follows not us, and we forbid him because he follows not us. Verse 40, Jesus says, John, he that's not against us, John, is on our part. He throws John's own term back at him. Now, sometimes we're a bit like John in life, aren't we? We feel strongly about an issue, we get all het up about it, and we go steaming into battle, ready to do what John did here. And it's not the right way. It's not how you handle things in the truth. You never ever handle issues in the truth that way. Not the right way. We don't show that intensity of spirit that is intolerant or aggressive towards others. Well, of course, sometime later on, if you come to Luke chapter 9, which was the reading that we had, sometime later on, of course, Jesus was on the way down south to Jerusalem, and he decided that he would go through the area of the Samaritans. It says in verse 51 of Luke chapter 9 that it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him, and they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? You see, when it says in verse 54, when his disciples James and John saw this, the word saw, which is the Greek word eido, indicates the direction of thought towards the object seen. Implies perception. You know how we say in life, someone explains something to us, we say, oh, yes, I see what you mean. And when we use that phrase, I see, we don't actually mean something we've seen with our eyes, do we? It's something that we've comprehended with our brain. And so when it says his disciples, James and John, saw this, what it really means is that they understood that these Samaritans had snubbed Christ. Now you don't do that, not with John around. John's far too protective of Jesus for anyone in the vicinity to snub. They've just snubbed our Lord. Immediate reaction from John. And so you see what John says with his brother. They said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? Oh, this is grand stuff, isn't it? Any idea why John said that? Well, I think there are actually two things that could be brought to bear upon that. If you come back for a moment to Matthew chapter 11, John had already heard these words says in Matthew chapter 11, John has recently heard Jesus say this. Then began he, verse 20, to upbraid the cities wherein most of his mighty works were done, because they repented not, and said, "Woe unto thee, Chorazin! Woe unto thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you. And thou, Capernaum, which art exalted unto heaven, shall be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which had been done in thee had been done in Sodom, it would have remained unto this day." And so Jesus has already brought down, just recently, judgment on the cities of Galilee. And so one can imagine John thinking, well, if Jesus can bring down judgment upon the cities of Galilee in Israel, what about these Samaritan cities? Let's blast them off the face of the earth. That'll solve the problem. And not only that, but if you come back to Luke chapter 9, one of the things about this was, you see, that Luke 9 tells us that they'd only recently come down from a high mountain. And who had they seen on the high mountain? Peter was one of the ones up there. Who had they seen talking with Jesus? Why, one of the very men they'd just seen on the Mount of Transfiguration was Elijah. And Elijah was in John's brain. And they come into the Samaritan village. Christ is snubbed, and John's immediate reaction was, right. All right? And the spirit of Elijah flashes back into his mind, and he says, let's blast them off the face of the earth. Actually, the diglot says, "Master, dost thou wish that we command fire?" And you see, again, what's it motivated for? Or what's it motivated by? John's jealous love for Christ. He felt very jealous about Christ. He didn't like people snubbing Jesus. Now you see, in a way, that was a wonderful spirit, wasn't it? Wouldn't you like to feel so strong about Christ as John? Wouldn't you like to have that strength of feeling? Do you feel that way? Do I feel that way? Do we feel as intense about the truth as John? Now in a way, that's a good thing, isn't it? You see, that intensity wasn't based on confidence in himself. John was 100% committed to the truth. But along with that, there was a problem here with regard to his attitudes. And verse 55 says that Jesus turned and rebuked him and said, "You don't know what manner of spirit ye are of. For the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And so also was the spirit of Elijah," wasn't it? Because the spirit of Elijah was really the spirit of the still small voice to build up and to heal and to restore. And he says, "You think you know all about Elijah, John?" He says, "You don't know what spirit Elijah had." And so what does Jesus do? End of verse 56. They went to another village. So Christ avoided the confrontation. Do you know why he avoided the confrontation? Because it wouldn't have been of any benefit in the truth, would it? It wouldn't have done anything good for the truth to have had an argument with the Samaritans on this occasion. And you see, there's a key here. You see, what the Lord is doing is he's rebuking John on this occasion for vindictive intolerance. A slightly different story to the previous one. He's rebuking John here for vindictive, command fire, intolerance, and destroy them. And Jesus says, "Look, John, that's far too strong, that's far too extreme, that's far too judgmental, that's not how you act in the truth. Doesn't matter how right you think you are, there's never ever room for that sort of spirit of intensity." And Jesus gave an example what to do. He says, "Look, just leave it alone." And they walked to another village. You see, there are some people who are unnecessarily combative in the truth. They always want to have an argument. They always want to pick a fight. And the approach they take is always that sort of approach, and it's confrontational. "What do you think about this, brother? I don't agree with what you said." Boom, bang, crash, bang. You know, it doesn't work, does it? And the problem is that John had to learn that too. John had to learn that he'd never ever helped the ecclesia as long as he banged his way around like that. He had to learn to temper his strength of feelings with a greater wisdom in how he handled people and how he worked with other people in the truth. You see, all these men had to change. It's not good enough for John to say, well, I'm just strong and that's the way I am. You just have to accept me, that's the way I'm built. Not good enough. Truth's designed to change us. Not to justify what our existing character is. You know, we all have strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, I think there's a really good lesson here about the truth. You see, there are some things that we're all naturally good at. You take a person who's naturally a good organiser, and so they run a camp or a study weekend and say, oh, isn't that person a good, oh, they're a diligent person for the truth. Look, they're running around to marvellous organisation for the truth. Well, so it might have been, but you see, it could just be that that person's got a natural talent to do that anyway. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there are some other people that you would know that you would never ask them to organise a camp. Things might not be there, like salt or teapots or toilet rolls or something. But some people have a natural skill, don't they? But you see how easy it would be to say, well, there's a fine person in the truth. Well, so it might be, but it could just be that that person's got a natural ability in that regard. You see, when the day of judgment comes, do you think that person will be judged as worthy simply because they displayed their natural ability? No, Christ's more interested in the areas that they had in their life where there was change needed, not where they already had natural. What about a person who, for example, is naturally quiet? People say, you know, he's a marvellous, you know, she's a marvellous sister, very humble person. Now, she might be humble, but you know, some people are naturally quiet and self-effacing, aren't they? You know what I mean? They were like that before they came to the truth. So you see, the issue is not whether they're quiet, but whether it's the truth that motivates that quietness. You see what I'm saying? Because a person could be like that anyway. The challenge of the truth is all about how the truth has changed our bad points, not about the natural good points we already had anyway. So it's not good enough for John to say, well, I just feel strongly about things and you've got to accept me. No, no, John, you've got to change. You've got to learn to control that intensity of feeling so that you are not, as in this case, vindictively intolerant of other people because they have done something that you think is wrong. All right, there's another one still to come, and it's back in the Gospel of Mark again. And this time it's in Mark chapter Mark chapter 10. And here's a good illustration on this occasion of how a person that's too strong about things can in the end start to upset other people, and that their work becomes detrimental to the truth in the overall sense. Now, in verse 35 of Mark chapter 10, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come unto him saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. Actually, this is a really good statement when you think about it. You know how little kids come up and say, Dad, will you promise to give me whatever I want? Say, well, son, depends what it is you're going to ask. Now you see what these two boys do. They can you imagine, you know, ever thought about Christ smiling? I'm sure Christ smiled sometimes. He must have smiled at his disciples. Now these two boys come up, here's John, one of them, they come up and they say, Master, yes, we wouldest that thou should do for us whatever we ask. And I can just see Jesus with a smile on his face in verse 36 saying, what would you that I should do for you? Can you see that? Because you see, they really wanted this, didn't they? You see that intensity of feeling? John really wanted this. Now what did he want? Well, verse 37. Not much really, just a little, you know, a little help. They said, grant unto us that we may sit one on thy right hand and the other on thy left hand in thy glory. Just a little request really. In fact, I'll tell you how the Diagogue puts it, because it gives you the spirit of what John was aiming at here. They said, verse 37, that one at right of thee and one at left of thee we may sit in the glory of thee. What did they want? John says, I just want to be near you. I want to be next to you in the kingdom. You see how he loved the Lord? Oh, he loved Christ, didn't he? He really did. You can never ever blame John for that. He really loved Christ. That one at left of thee and one at right of thee, we may sit in the glory of thee. But it's all about being near Christ. Please, will you do what we ask? Says John. Well, verse 38 says that Jesus said unto them, look, he says, you don't know what you're asking for. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? And they said, can you hear John? We can. They didn't even know what was in that cup, did they, at that time? In fact, the word can, by the way, here in verse 39 is the word dunamai. What does that mean? We have the power to, yep, no troubles. You want us to drink the cup? Not a problem, we've got the power to do that, yep. You see, John was so strong that he wanted that. I want to be with Christ, I want to be near Christ. Can you drink of my cup? Yep, sure can. Very strong. You see, you know, now verse 40 says, well, verse 39, Jesus said, ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized with all shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my... And by the way, that did happen, didn't it? Because which disciple died first? Anyone remember? Whereabouts is that? Acts chapter 12. Actually, Herod killed him, didn't he? And so James was the first apostle to lose his life in the cause of the truth, the brother of John, and so James did first drink of that cup. But I'm sure they never knew that when they said, we can, back here in Mark chapter 10. And Jesus says, but to sit on my right hand, verse 40, and on my left hand, is not mine to give, but it shall be given to those for whom it's prepared. And when the 10 heard it, they began to be much displeased with James and John, as well we might imagine that the 10 would be. And you see how that John's thoughtlessness here had led, because of his own strength of feeling, had led now to tensions within the rest of the members of the apostles. The other 10 said, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? So Jesus really has to rebuke John again on this occasion. Now, what's he rebuking John for this time? Well, he's rebuking John for thoughtless ambition, isn't he? Thoughtless ambition, because it was an ambition at the expense of others. John says, I don't care about anyone else, but I do want to be near Christ myself. Jesus says, you can't be like that. So you see how you've got these three episodes. Mark chapter 9, he's rebuked for short-sighted aggressiveness. Luke chapter 9, he's rebuked for vindictive intolerance. Mark chapter 10, he's rebuked for thoughtless ambition. But they were all manifestations of the same spirit, the son of Ragaz. Far, far too strong. See the problem? Now, John had to learn to overcome that spirit. And I think there are times in our life when we're all a bit like that. We're a bit too intense about our feelings, perhaps a bit too aggressive, a bit too strong in our dealings with other people. It's never, ever the right way to be like that. Not saying that we shouldn't have a love for the truth. Of course we should. But tempered with that needs to come an appreciation of how to deal with other people. Well, you see, the Lord knew that, didn't he? The Lord must have known that, because it's he that called them Boanerges. Now, funnily enough, I think that the last night of the Lord's life was the night that John learnt his lesson. Now, you see, if you come to the record of John chapter 19, you can imagine the amazement that John had that night Jesus had shown so much care and thoughtfulness for other people. He'd shown thoughtfulness for Judas. He dealt with Peter. He'd explained something to Thomas. He'd been kind to Philip. He'd talked to Judas, the other Judas, not that which was Iscariot. If you go through the record of John's Gospel, it's all in John's Gospel, by the way, you'll find event after event after event that night that John writes down, where he catalogues all the things that Jesus did that night to show care for other people. I think that really impressed John. And finally, it extended now to an episode that involved John himself, because in John 19, in verse 25, it says, "Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Cleophas and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples standing by whom he loved, he said unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. And then said he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour that disciple took her unto his own home." So here's Jesus on the cross, about to expire, and here's Mary his mother, and here's John. Now, you see, it's interesting, really. Doesn't that ring true? Of all the disciples, who's there to witness the last moment? It's John. Isn't that what we'd expect of John? Because he's the most intense of all of them, isn't he? I want to be near Christ. And of all the disciples, we wouldn't be surprised, would we, to find that the one at the cross, at the time of the end, as Christ is about to expire, is John. Oh, that rings true, doesn't it? And what does John see? He beholds Jesus' eyes open and he focuses down. He sees his own mother. And what does John see him do? He sees the last recorded act of care that Jesus shows for yet another person that night before he died. For his own mother. And all through that night, John was being taught, care for others, care for others, care for others. You go through John's Gospel and read that carefully and see how that spirit comes out. And that was the very lesson that John himself needed to learn. He saw it that night. He was there. He witnessed the compassion of the Lord. Remember how he said in John chapter 13, we made reference to that phrase, little children. And of course, it's John finally that takes that term up in his epistles, doesn't he? What have we often described the epistles of John as, by the way? The epistles of love. Now that's interesting, isn't it? So here is a man who's rebuked for short-sighted aggressiveness, who's rebuked for vindictive intolerance, who's told off for thoughtless ambition at the expense of other people, and he's the man who finally writes the epistles of brotherly love. Did John learn his lesson? Must have. And the Son of Thunder had to write about how to deal gently with one another. And he takes that phrase up from John 13. And over again in his epistles, he says, "My little children, you should do this. You should do that." And if we read the epistles of John, we have all the tenderness, all the care, all the patience, all the wisdom of a man who, I believe, no doubt still felt strongly about the truth and still loved the Lord with a burning flame that had never dimmed, but it had been tempered now with a wisdom and a care and a moderation for other people that would seek the best interests of the truth. You know, that's one of the things that we always ought to ask ourselves whenever we are going to do something before we do it. You know, when you're ready to do something, inverted commas, I'm going to do something about this. Well, before you do that, you should always say, is this going to be the best for the truth? What I'm going to do, or the way I'm going to do it, or the words I'm going to use. Will it be the best for the truth that I do it this way? That's what John had to learn, wasn't it? And he did learn. And he's asked to write, finally, the epistles of brotherly love. I think that's a lovely point that comes out. In fact, come and have a look at this. In Matthew chapter 11, we're told in Matthew 11, this is one of the prayers of Christ. Verse 25. Just read these words. O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things, I thank thee because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent and hast revealed them unto babes, even so, Father, for so it seemed good in thy sight. Now listen to these words. All things are delivered unto me of my Father, and no man knoweth the Son but the Father. Neither knoweth any man the Father save the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son will reveal him. Okay, now come and have a look at John's epistle. First epistle of John. And chapter 2. Verse 22. Who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son. Whosoever denieth the Son, the same hath not the Father, but he that acknowledgeth the Son hath the Father also. Let that therefore abide in you which you've heard from the beginning. If that which you've heard from the beginning shall remain in you, ye also shall continue in the Son and in the Father. You see the language? Where did John get his thoughts and his language from in his first epistle? That comes straight out of the prayer of Jesus in Matthew 11. All things are delivered unto me of my Father, and no man knoweth the Son but the Father. Neither knoweth any man the Father save the Son, he to whomsoever the Son will reveal it. The very language of John, ultimately, is a reflection of the language of Jesus himself, and that's why Jesus loved him, because not only was John intense in his feelings, but he was the disciple that thought the most like Christ. Well, 3 days later we have an indication of the consideration for others that John, we believe, learnt over that night. By the way, you might just like to take a note of this, see if you can work out where these phrases are. Although we've got a few statements here that John said, do you know that out of all the references into John's life, and there's quite a few of them, that John only ever opens his mouth 5 times? And the 5 statements that John makes are really interesting in terms of seeing the burning spirit of this man. Now, you ready? Here they are. And the 5 statements that John makes are really interesting in terms of seeing the burning spirit of this man. Are you ready? Here they are. See if you can tell me where they are. Number 1. Master, where dwellest thou? Where's that from? Right, good little puzzle here. Where's that? Probably worth just putting this together, because it's a really interesting little, it's a real reflection on John. If you've got these 5 references, it tells you all about his attitude. Now, where does that phrase come from? John 1 verse 38. Alright, now we won't look at these references in detail, but you might just like to take a note of them. But there were 2 men, you see, that followed Jesus. We believe the 2 men were Andrew and John. They both had a brother each, and they both went off to find the brother, and John's writing this story. But in his modesty in John 1, he doesn't say that it was actually him. But believe that that's a phrase that they asked. This is coming out of John's mouth. Master, Where dwellest thou? That's the first phrase. Here's the second one. Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name and we forbade him. Where's that? That's Mark 9 verse 38, isn't it? Here's the third one. Master, wilt thou that we command fire from heaven? That's Luke 9. Here's the fourth one. Master, we wouldest that thou should do for us whatever we ask. That's Mark 10. Here's the next one. Oh, now where's this one? Master, who is it? Where's that? John 13, in the upper room. And here's the last one. You watching? It's the Master. John 21. Now you see the common element to the five times that John speaks? That's the one he loved. There's something real telltale there, isn't there? Every time John opens his mouth in the gospel records, the name of the Master is on his lips. Would to God, brothers and sisters and young people, that we have that love for the truth and for our Lord. Nothing wrong with that. Just a case of learning the wisdom to temper that in terms of our dealings with one another. And so on most occasions, despite the fact that we've looked at those times when he speaks, on most occasions, in fact, John is the silent and thoughtful observer of all that he did. And here's the record of the times John actually occurs in special circumstances in the narrative. He was there at the healing of Peter's mother-in-law in Mark 1 verse 29. He saw the miraculous draught of fishes in Luke chapter 5. He witnessed the raising of Jairus' daughter in Luke chapter 8. He was there at the transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17. He heard the Olivet prophecy in Mark chapter 13. He was there at the exposure of Judas at the supper in John chapter 13. He saw the agony in the garden in Matthew 26. He witnessed the trial of Christ in John chapter 18. He saw the crucifixion at Golgotha in John chapter 19. He saw the empty tomb in John chapter 20, and he saw the miraculous draught of fish in John 21. Whatever was going on in the life of Jesus, you'll see John always there, but he in fact very rarely opens his mouth. But when he does, it's always got the word Master on it. But generally he's just there watching, absorbing, learning everything that Jesus did. Now, remember we said we're just going to look at how he'd learnt that lesson of tolerance to others. Well, let's have a look at the next day, or in fact it was 3 days later, when they come to the empty tomb. It's in John chapter 20. We're told, of course, in John 20 verse 2, that Mary Magdalene runs and comes to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said unto him, they've taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we know not where they've laid him. And Peter therefore went forth, and that other disciple, and came to the sepulchre. So they ran both together, and the other disciple did outrun Peter, and came first to the sepulchre. Now who was the other disciple? The other disciple was John, wasn't he? Why do you think he outrun Peter? Was he younger? Did he have longer legs? Did he know the way better? What do you think the reason was? Any thoughts? Because John was always a ball of intensity, wasn't he? And look, it could have been all those things, by the way. I'm not saying that it wasn't, that he was younger and had longer legs or whatever, but it just seems to me to ring true to John's character. He has two men running to see. Now Peter was enthusiastic. You know how Peter felt about Christ? He wanted to be there too, but John had more intensity than even Peter, and off they went. John's miles ahead. He was just that sort of bloke. No one would have beaten John that day for that tomb. But you notice what he did. It says in verse 5 that although he got there first, he stooping down and looked and saw the linnet, but he didn't go in. He stood to the side and he allowed Peter, who probably was the older of the two, he allowed Peter to go in first. Now that was a thoughtful touch, wasn't it? You see, he now has a spirit of thoughtfulness for others. He realised that he'd run with Peter. Oh, he loved the Lord, he got there first, but he gave Peter the first chance to walk in. Now, just hold your finger in John chapter 20 and come back to Luke chapter 24. And just see the difference between the two men, by the way, because it's quite interesting. In Luke chapter 24 and verse 12, it says of Peter, "Then arose Peter and ran unto the sepulchre, and stooping down he beheld the linen clothes laid by themselves, and departed, wondering in himself at that which was come to pass." Do you think Peter had worked it out? What was going on here? No, I don't think so. Now come back to John chapter 20. John chapter 20 says, verse 6, "Then comes Simon Peter following him, and went into the sepulchre, and sees the linen clothes lie." And so Luke adds, "And he departed, wondering in himself at what was happening." Verse 8, "Then went in also that other disciple, which came first to the sepulchre, and he saw and believed." See the difference between the two men? John gets there first. He had more firepower to his legs that day. He stands aside and lets Peter. In comes Peter, good old loyal bouncing Peter, comes in, sees all the grave clothes, and walks out scratching his head, and blood if I know what's going on, and walks off wondering at what was all about. And then John walks in, the quieter, the more intense, the more thoughtful of the two. He walks in and he looks at what he sees. And he saw, says the record, and he believed. He had a deeper understanding than Peter, this man. A much deeper spiritual understanding of the Lord's work and what was going on. But he had now learnt that he had to work with other people in the truth and to show care and thoughtfulness towards them. Son of Ragaz. Oh, Jesus knew exactly whom he'd chosen, and he knew that every one of these men had something to overcome. So if there's times when you feel that you're shaking because of how strong you feel, remember John. In fact, I just might close by quoting a really good hymn, and I've always liked this hymn. I've quoted it to several others before, but it's really good. It's about, "O Master, it is good to be." Just listen to this in terms of the three men that were with Jesus on the Mount. See if you can work out who it is. "O Master, it is good to be with thee and with thy faithful three. Here where the apostle's heart of rock is nerved against temptation's shock." Who's that? Isn't that a good allusion to Peter? Cephas, the rock. There are Peter, you see. How about this one? Now be careful now. "Here where the Son of Thunder learns the thought that breathes and word that burns." Now that's actually James. "Wilt thou that we command fire to come down?" You learn the fire of the word that burns in the hearts of people, James. Here's the last man. "Here where on eagle's wings we move with him." Who's that? The man who writes the gospel of the eagle. Jesus as the Son of God. That's John, isn't it? "Here where on eagle's wings we move," now listen to this, "with him whose last best creed is love." Isn't that good? And that's what John had to learn. Not just love for his Lord, but a love for the truth that would reach out to embrace other people who also had been called to follow the Lord. If we can learn that principle, then we will have learned something of value from the life of this Son of Thunder.